Well, happy holidays, everyone, and happy new year. Today's featured guest, Martin Armstrong. Martin Armstrong, the author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, founder of Princeton Economics, and of course his latest, The Forecaster, the must-see documentary slash movie about his astounding life. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're back in from Europe. Assume there was, it was a speaking tour or something.
Well, we have our conferences. They're kind of like mini UN get-togethers for the week. There's a world that we call them the World Economic Conference. We have one here in the States, and then we have one in Berlin. So clients fly in from all over the world, and it's really good because you get to meet people from everywhere, and you get to see the capital flows right there in the room.
Well, yeah, capital flows. That's a good topic to start off with. On your interesting documentary, The Forecaster, much more than just the typical docudrama. Capital flows in and out of a nation. An important key to your analysis whenever you're looking at the potential for a prospective break in an economic paradigm or at least in a specific economy. We've seen a lot of that. Argentina, Venezuela. Do you see anything else like that?
Well, sure. I mean, capital flows around the globe and people don't quite appreciate this so much, but it's becoming a bit more obvious to them now. But for years, back in the 80s, when I was doing a lot of business in Geneva, everybody was there handling OPEC money, etc. In the late 80s, I'm off over in Japan, and initially I thought, gee, I don't know anybody over here, being asked to go over. And here, a lot of the top brokers that were handling the OPEC money in Geneva had migrated to Japan. The capital not only moves around the world, but so does the talent. After the Japan bubble, what happened? And they say, okay, what's next? And they all ran down to Southeast Asia. That goes into a bubble by 97, and so we get the Asian currency crisis. They go, oh, what's next? Oh, they're going to start the euro next year. And they all run into that. So it's always this rush around the world sort of thing. Governments, it's very important because politicians, it really shows that honestly, they're full, they're full of it. I mean, they can't do anything that they claim that they can do. And that's part of the problem we're seeing in political elections everywhere. I mean, they're dumbfounded, half the time why Trump is at the top. But if you look around the world, it's the same thing everywhere. In Scotland, they threw every member of the Labour Department out of Parliament. People are fed up.
Just saw today on the headlines, the Pope actually is expecting a potential for World War III today. You've got your finger on the pulse of the geo-economic situation better than most. What are your thoughts on a potential wide-scale conflict? This sounds like something of a wake-up call. Do the elite know something that the rest of us need to know here?
I've been told a lot of them are starting to look at our models a bit more. But effectively, it isn't really like Nobel Prize-winning stuff here. I mean, we took the world economy, we reconstructed everything from the coinage, etc. You can see charts on the Roman economy that we reconstructed. And you correlate that for thousands of years with war. And it comes up with a very simple explanation. We do not go to war when everybody's fat and happy. Turn the economy down. Everything starts going. You have to understand, all right, 1933, yes, FDR was elected, confiscated gold, etc. That's a very myopic view. 1933, Hitler was also elected, and so was Mao. So this is a global thing. It is you turn the economy down, and everybody gets angry at somebody else.
That's an interesting phrase, turn the economy down. I think that's appropriate. And didn't we just see that last week with the FOMC turning the economy down? Certainly by raising rates first time in almost 10 years, that's going to be a sea change event, some reverberations through the economy, don't you think?
The Fed was positioned and should have raised rates in June and was going to. And what happened, the IMF came out publicly, and you can look, Google it out. you'll see that they came turn to the press criticizing the Federal Reserve that they should not be raising rates because of other problems in the world. You know, you have the emerging markets that since 2007 effectively borrowed in dollar terms, because they did it in dollars, the equivalent of half the U.S. national debt. They have nothing to pay it back with. Their economies are imploding, and the higher the dollar goes, the more they owe, and the less they earn because commodities go down. The Fed is in a huge problem, and that is that by keeping interest rates very low, it's ridiculous. The banks do not pass on any benefit to borrowers. So that's just total nonsense. The only thing it does is increases the balance sheets for banks. That's all. They make a windfall production out of it. They pay people for deposits nothing. You still want to go get a fully, a car loan or something that's fully collateralized? What do they want? 4% and more. The historic spread between bid and ask is at all-time record highs. So the banks love this, and Yellen realizes what's going on. She's been telling everybody we have to normalize interest rates, because what's happening is the pension funds are all going bust. Most of them needed 8% just to be able to break even. And we're not talking about just private ones. We're talking about the ones that she's really worried about are all the states, New Jersey, Illinois, for example. I mean, they could even pay the lottery winners. Her raising rates is actually something else. It is when you do a simple correlation, guess what? The stock market rises with rising interest rates. It declines with lower interest rates. And the reason is quite interesting. It's all before this Marxist idea. If you read the newspapers pre-1929, the Fed would raise rates and everybody would cheer. That proves the economy's strong. People are still bidding for money. Let's go higher. All right. When interest rates come down, they're trying to stimulate because nobody wants to buy. So if you look at interest rates, they doubled between 1927 and 29. They went from 3% to 6%. And then from 1929 to 1932, when the Dow fell 90%, they went basically from 6 to 1. So when you actually do the correlations on this stuff, it's opposite of what they say on TV.
So maybe we should move into, the precious metals. Very tough 4 or 5 years for the yellow metal, for AG. Do you see any silver lining here on the horizon? Will they outperform with higher rates?
No, really, it has nothing to do with the higher rates just yet. A lot of them, I mean, this is typical. You are in a period where I know a lot of people, you end up being dollar haters, and they keep saying, it's got to crash. They don't realize how bad everything is outside the United States.
That's the key, yeah.
The euro is a basket case, absolute basket case. I mean, they're using draconian measures, trying to force people not to do things. And the currency, they never properly designed it. There had to be one national debt for Europe, and they didn't do it. They left every country with its own debt. So you have the same problem emerging, in the emerging markets that you have in Europe. Why did Greece and Spain and Italy and Portugal get into trouble? Because they sold them this idea of joining the euro. The euro then went from 80 cents to $1.60. Okay, now, if you borrow Mexican pesos and the peso doubles in value, you now owe twice as much. And this is what has absolutely stripped mine Southern Europe. And it's creating a tremendous problem. You have unemployment there among the youth over 60%. I mean, this is civil unrest. This is your war cycle. I mean, people can't take this. And then instead, Brussels, understanding that this is their fault, what have they done? They're enforcing tax collection more. And they're now starting on Greece, and you're going to see this migrate to other countries. They must report everything they have right down to jewelry as of January 1st. Anything you have, not in a bank. So if you've got cash underneath your mattress, how much do you have in gold jewelry? I mean, if you have a lot of gold jewelry on and you go to hop on a plane in Italy, guess what? You get pulled over and they weigh it. I mean, people don't realize how bad this is getting. I just came back from Europe. This is the first time I get pulled over. They're not looking for trinkets, how much, you know, alcohol or cigarettes or how many T-shirts did you buy. The first question out of his mouth was, how much cash do you have on you? I looked at him and I said, about $2,000. And they go over and search absolutely everything. And I had to show them a receipt. Look, I took $2,000 out. I left with it in case something happens to a credit card. I'm not stranded. I didn't spend it. Here's my withdrawal slip from a U.S. bank. Okay, fine. And I left. But they still kept me there for a half hour going through everything. And they're only looking for money.
You know, and that really, I think, is a good tie-in into this cashless society. It's a theme that we see gaining momentum around the world, not just in the U.S., not just domestically, but all over. As a result of that, and I think a lot of currency unrest around the world, we see Bitcoin taking off, doubling in just a matter of weeks yet again, showing all kinds of signs of life. Folks can now trade it as an ETF. It's something like GBTC, I think, is the NASDAQ ticker symbol. Do you see the cashless society idea mantra as another risk to our liberties?
Oh, yes. I mean, the whole thing is all about taxes. Maybe a lot of people aren't aware of it, but as of, you know, 2017, the G20 have agreed that everybody has to share information on everybody. So, you know, whatever you do, if you go down to Mexico and you bought a house or something, they will have to report it to the United States that, hey, you own property now. They're looking for money absolutely everywhere. I went over to London from Brussels. I was there in some high-level meetings. And dressed. So I had a suit and tie on, and I ran over to hop onto the train to run over to for a meeting, you know, through the tunnel in London. So I happened to be the only one actually dressed. Everybody else was in jeans and sneaks. Again, I'm the one called over. This was, you know, the British customs. They say, you, come here. I said, yeah. Showed my passport. Look, I'm not British. I'm American. That still wasn't good enough. They said, okay, let me see your ticket. I said, my ticket. They went to see where I bought it. If I bought my ticket in London and was I returning, I said, no, I bought it in Brussels and I'm just here for a meeting and I go back to the States from Frankfurt. Okay, fine. Then they let me go. It's all money. That's all it is. And this is what this cashless society is about. If they can eliminate physical paper money, and everything has to be in a bank, then they can collect every possible, you know, penny of tax that they think they're entitled to. And this is what they're doing to Greece. The Greeks, as of January 1st, have to report everything they have. And it's under criminal, you know, penalties.
Do you see something like that coming to our doors?
Eventually, the EU is doing this to Greece. The same way when they started the bail-ins, taking people's money to bail out the banks and the deposits. They did that first in Cyprus, and they watched to see if they got away with it. They did. So they then expanded the idea to everywhere else. They're now doing this, reporting everything you have.
What about listeners that are scratching their heads thinking, okay, yes, you're right, they did get away with it, but does that really tie in with the top of this cartel? Because can't they just print an unlimited amount of money? Why would they need to steal from mom and pop if they've got the control of the printing presses?
Because they don't see it that way. They really don't. And the people that buy the bonds are the ones that are telling them, no, you can't do that. They don't want to be paid back with funny money. So what you get is more austerity. It's more draconian. The deficits still keep rising, true, but they become much more draconian in the sense of trying to collect taxes, raising taxes, everything they possibly can get. This is why the G20, as of 2017, is going to share information on absolutely everybody.
Okay, so let's shift over to the domestic economy for a minute. Your work has been on spot with many calls and over the decades, but you know, one of the more recent cycles that seems to be of relevance to our listeners is a potential downturn for U.S. equities. We saw some of that a couple of months ago. I had a little scare. Do you see anything bigger like that, or will the presidential election put it off even further?
No, it could push it off. It looks like the real big volatility period is probably 17 going into 20. The stock market's not going to crash and go to 10 cents on the dollar. If anything, it's going to probably go up, and you could see the Dow hitting at least the 25, 26,000 area. If not, you go all the way and you go up to about 40,000. Why? Because at some point in time, the real capital looks at this and realizes what you're talking about, you know, funny money and printing and stuff like that. They basically realize that this is a joke, and it becomes capital preservation. So at that stage in the game, you're looking at things, just all sorts of tangible assets then start to rise as the hedge against government. And that's the end of the cycle. So we're probably at that point looking for some sort of monetary collapse, change. The part of what we're looking at right in here is that this pushes everything up quite dramatically, because the system of borrowing, it's just nuts. I mean, there is no intention of paying anything back. And I mean, you can go to our site and look, we've published charts on this. 70% of the national debt is accumulative interest. So it didn't go for building roads or schools or helping the poor or anybody. And, you know, it basically goes out as interest out the back door. This is why the banks have such a control over government. They get bailed out every time because they threaten them. And they say, well, you know, if you don't bail us out, then who's going to sell your debt? And so it's been this blackmail game that's been going on for a long time. And they get to do anything they want. They control the courts. They control the government. And, I mean, I know people in Capitol Hill, and they said they would never, you know, investigate Goldman Sachs. And you ask them why. It's because everybody's looking to work for them at some point when they retire.
Give us your overview of what you think we could see. Maybe if we look forward into 2016, throw some topicality in there and any forecasts or predictions, if you like, please.
It looks as though, you know, we'll probably at least get an initial low, if maybe not the final low on most of the commodities. It really kind of depends upon how we close year end on a lot of these things. I mean, gold, you close below the 1040 area, and you're going to crack the 1000 next year. And oil, the real huge number is at like $32. If it closes below that for the year end, you're never going to see oil make new highs. I mean, it will rally back, eventually get maybe back to $50 and then fall back down again. But we're also in a very dramatic sea change as far as technology is concerned. You know, you have Teslas. I mean, when I went to Amsterdam, the taxis are Teslas. The advance in battery technology, et cetera, cars are being replaced. BMWs, within 2 years, expecting to have electric cars for absolutely every model. So the U.S. also has become the largest producer of oil. People don't realize this, but it actually has exceeded Saudi Arabia. This is with, you know, fracking, et cetera. So, I mean, there is quite a glut of oil on the market, which is why price has been coming down and people don't quite understand what's going on. But this is disrupting budgets absolutely everywhere. It's making the effectively wiping out a lot of the BRICS in Russia, Brazil. It's having a very, very major impact in shifting things around, but this is part of the whole structure where eventually when we get through this tunnel, the light on the other side is going to be some sort of new monetary system. And hopefully at that point, we will get to the stage where we will no longer be borrowing money. You borrow money if you intend to pay it back. Effectively, what they should be doing is just increasing the money supply to cover the cost of government. And if you eliminate taxation, the cost of government can be really just kept at well below 10%. Almost 40% of the cost of government is trying to collect taxes. And taxes are no longer necessary at the federal level. They were necessary when money was coins, gold, silver, etc. Then you couldn't just print it. You had to get some back. We've passed that stage. I mean, that was pretty much still part of the barter-type economy. We're beyond that. Really, the wealth of a nation, I think, was set out by Adam Smith and his invisible hand, but it's been proving absolutely correct. It's not even the resources a country has, it's commodities or gold reserves or anything. It's its people. And the proof of that is just look at Germany, Japan, and China. Germany was absolutely devastated. It has risen. Why? Because of its people, to the strongest economy again in Europe. All right, they're very productive, very efficient. Japan, all right, had nothing. All right, not even resources. They had to import everything. They rose to the second largest economy in the world. You look at China. Now, I can tell you what the difference is between China and Russia. I've been to both before, the walls fell, etc. The difference is Stalin versus Mao. Stalin was concerned about what you thought about. All right, if children were raised to say that the state is really your parents, and if your biological parents speak ill against the government, report them. All right, so Stalin was paranoid. And he basically really suppressed human activity and human nature. China took the opposite approach. China, they had what was called the tall poppy syndrome. They really didn't care what you thought. If you stuck your head up, it got cut off. If you kept your mouth shut and you were behind closed doors, they didn't care. Stalin cared. So you can see the difference in the sense that the Chinese people were never oppressed, from a standpoint of their natural human nature. So they responded as soon as they could, immediately right back. Russia went from basically communism to an oligarchy.
You sort of see some tie-ins there with the repressive ideologies and policy making all throughout the Western world?
Yeah, I mean, they're basically, I can tell you, people I speak to in Europe all the time, they're calling it now that, and some politicians are even now publicly calling it, Europe is the Soviet Union of Europe.
I don't think we ever expected to see anything quite that extreme. Are we referring mostly to socialist policies and ideologies here?
It's more than that. They have actively gone after, they've had the head of Italy removed. They have sent in their own people to really rig the elections in Scotland. They and the same in Portugal. The people voted for a party to get rid of to leave the EU. They wouldn't even allow them to take office. In Spain, they came down and said they had no right to even vote for it. They are trying so hard to oppress any resistance to leave the euro because they know this is all about Brussels and their jobs. If the euro goes, why do we need bureaucrats in Brussels? They could care less what happens to the continent or to the people. This is now all about government surviving. And so it's becoming extremely draconian. And you talk about democracy is dead. All right. First of all, we never had democracy. At best, we had was a representative type government. But look at Europe. All right. You can vote for someone to go sit in Parliament in Brussels. Very nice. The Commission does not have to listen to them. It's a ceremonial vote. The Commission decides what they want to do. They're under no obligation to follow whatever Parliament even votes on. Secondly, you have the Troika, okay? Head of the ECB, the head of the EU Commission, and the head of the IMF. None of them, all right, stand for election. It's a complete dictatorship. We live in this facade, and the free press does not tell anybody what's really going on. But you know, if you're European, you said, look, I had enough of this. I think these people are wrong. Okay, I want to vote against them. You don't even have a right to vote.
It's a star chamber, a hidden room filled with smoke, and they're calling the shots and you know, oh, sure, you can have your elections, but they're rigged anyway, and it's not going to affect anything at the top.
No, and you can't even vote for the people at the top. They don't ever have to stand for election.
You know, Martin, it kind of brings me back to your idea here of maybe 24, 25, 40,000 on the U.S. Dow Jones. You know, and that really, I think, ties in, or there's some parallels between the hyperinflation that we saw in the Weimar Republic, you know, around 21 to 23. You saw the stock market take off like a rocket, but so did anything, any place you could hide your money, because, you know, inflation was just destroying everything. Do you see anything like that in the cycles?
What people don't realize about the Weimar situation was that you got to look a little bit closer. All right. It was a communist revolution in 1918. That was the Weimar Republic. They even invited Russia to please come in and take Germany. But what made it hyperinflation? And it's not the fact that they were printing money. That's not the issue. The issue was they defaulted on all of the government debt. Whatever the previous government owned, they said they're not honoring. You wiped out all kinds of savings. You wiped out banks and stuff. So, yes, it ended up that they ended up having to print money because there was nothing else left. Totally destroyed the credibility of the government. Nobody would lend the money, so they had no choice but to print. And that's really what the hyperinflation was about. It was a complete collapse of the debt structure. All right. Now, we don't reach that in the West without such a similar situation. All right. And we're in a sovereign debt crisis, and that's what the real crisis is about. When the big capital begins to realize, wait a minute, you know, this is just getting more bailouts, more bailouts, more bailouts, and the people that are broke are bailing out the other people that are broke. Then you start seeing capital move. This is why, you know, people keep saying, oh, the stock market's overvalued. Retail participation's at historic lows. How can you have a bubble? It's impossible. All right. Plus, I can tell you, you know, the joke has always been that the financial gods of Wall Street are not that gracious. They don't give you 10 times to sell the high. They give you one shot. All right, 1929, 1980 in gold, 89 in Tokyo. They give you one shot. They don't keep bringing the market back to the same price level time and time again. All right, the Dow went up to 1,000 in 1966, went back up in 68, went back up in 73, went back up in 1980. Finally, 85, it blasted through. It went from 1,000 to 6. All right, that's what we're looking at. The Dow keeps coming up here, testing this, you know, this 18, 19,000 level constantly. All right, it is telling you this is going much higher. All right, and that's what I said, it's going to see at least the 25, 26 area. The question is only time. All right, clearly our computer is showing from 17 on. It's like everybody goes, we're really in trouble. And it's not just, you know, people that maybe are your listeners, or when does it get to them? All right. That seems to be from 17 onward. So that's what we really have to look for. When does the majority say what's going on?
So, you know, it really also boils down to capital inflows from around the world, because, you know, you have Europe talking about even further into negative territory on their benchmark lending rates. The bottom line is there's nowhere else to park your money and earn any kind of reasonable return other than U.S. equities.
That's pretty much it. The U.S. in the 1.1 $1 trillion spending package they did for Christmas. In there is they repealed the foreign investor tax, which was put on in the late 1980s because the Japanese were coming and buying all the trophy stuff. So it was very an anti-Japanese movement, actually. And they repealed that. So now foreigners can come in, they can buy whatever they want. And most of this was lobbying from foreign pension funds. Money's just coming here. This is what's pushing the dollar up. You look down anywhere, and Britain basically threw out pretty much all foreigners in the real estate market. So the market over there, the property market in London crashed like almost, 12% in the first month. It's down probably closer to a third already. But instantaneously, my sources in New York said as soon as they passed that measure, they were buying properties in New York. Because what's happened is, all right, I published, and you can see a chart on the French stock market. The major high is still 2,000. That's what socialism has produced. They've chased everybody out. Nobody with any real sizable capital will stay there anymore. Goodyear closed down. Why? I mean, you may have heard it. The workers kidnapped the head of Goodyear and his family until they got their wage increases. And the government doesn't do anything about this. Oh, well, yeah, it's a labor movement. Yeah, they're entitled to do to kidnap you and your family until you acquiesce and give the union what they demand. Goodyear has shut down this plant. I mean, would you want to run it? Who is going to take their family there when your family can be kidnapped if you don't agree to workers' demands?
And fully sanctioned by the government.
And so all the other stock markets have made new highs, not France. France has been in the bear market since 2000, and they still don't get it. Well, we're just going to raise more taxes. There isn't anybody else left to tax. So they leave. And I was in London in a restaurant, and everybody was speaking French. And I looked, am I in Paris or am I in London? They were all French that moved to London because they won't live there.
Okay, so as we wrap up today, why don't you tell people, just give them an overview of The Forecaster, the must-see film here in 2015. Any other contact information or what else you're working on today?
Well, most of what you can see what we're working on is at armstrongeconomics.com. The movie is interesting. I mean, it was actually funded by Europeans. I had two other offers to make one by Americans, and I turned them down because, honestly, I didn't think that, any kind of a film produced in the United States could be free from interference from government or the banks. And they are going to make a Hollywood movie out of this now, and which is interesting. But again, it has to be funded from outside the country, because people I've spoken to in Hollywood, they said they would love to make this movie. And so what's the problem? They said the funding comes from the banks. So the banks aren't going to fund something that exposes what they do. So it's kind of a catch-22, which is why you'll never see a film like this produced in the United States. So it is basically something that is really it puts a lot of light on what was developing. I mean, long-term capital management collapse, how Putin became the head of Russia, was all, basically because people were trying to take over the country. And they were actually blackmailing Yeltsin. And, I mean, it's just the whole thing is just unbelievable. But this is the true story. It's really what happened. They were trying to get me to join in with them. And I said, Russia's going to collapse. And they paid bribes to the IMF. They thought they had everything nailed down. And you can't do it that way. You just can't. So the film has been the highest rated documentary/movie, I guess, in Europe. It's all They don't want to show it in the United States. The other country which is interesting, which they're battling over, is Switzerland. A company bought the distribution rights to distribute it in Switzerland, and they refused to show it. Paid for it. They don't want to show it. Because why? Because it affects all the banks. So in London, it had a debut in London. The very night of the debut, they took someone else who was a headhunter, and his name was Martin Armstrong. They put out a big article in the London Evening Standard over there saying Martin Armstrong says that bankers are worth every penny. And I'm getting calls and emails, oh, you should see what they're doing to you in the press over here. When I went online to look at it, it's got the other guy's picture. I said, no. I said, it's not me. It's this other guy. Just has the same name. They sent me a photograph of the print edition. It had my photograph. So the print edition has got my photograph. The online edition had somebody else's. You don't make mistakes like that. And it was the night of the debut.
So you think the elite they don't want this message to get too widespread?
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, it's, they don't want to expose what has really been going on. I mean, there's been a lot of people talking about it, but, I mean, I actually had all the proof. When it's talk, that's kind of cheap. But everybody knows, the banks have been, finagling markets. They don't get prosecuted for stuff. I mean, we had, and I published on our web, we had absolutely documentation of every manipulation going back into the 1980s. All right, phone conversations, tapes, etc. Because I would say they're back. They're going to take this market to here. They're going to do this one to there. I never said who, but I made sure I had everything documented in case somebody wanted to sue me. Somehow, some way, they found out about all that stuff. And the receiver, his name was Alan Cohen, threatened to throw all my lawyers in prison unless they turned over all those tapes. They turned them over. Alan Cohen then gets appointed magically as board member of Goldman Sachs, doesn't resign from the court, continues to work for the court and Goldman Sachs simultaneously. And then all this evidence that we had that would expose all the banks was magically destroyed in the collapse of World Trade Center 7. And I have a letter from the SEC. Oh, very sorry. All your files are gone. I published a letter on our web. So, I mean, I have things that are documented. So it's not just, a bunch of hot air.
Well, we appreciate your comments today, Martin Armstrong. We're all a bunch of tall poppies. Would you like to provide any contact information for Princeton Economics?
Well, I think the easiest thing is basically just to go to our main retail site, which is armstrongeconomics.com. From there, you can get to the Princeton sites. You can get to our artificial intelligence system we call Socrates, where it basically forecasts every market in the world, every stock, things of this nature. It's a fully functioning AI system, which actually the computer writes it. It's been quite interesting on that as well. So
you say you have an artificial intelligence program which actually augments its own code to probably keep up with the shifting tides within the markets?
Yes, it's actually, we have one model in there which is very fascinating. It's called the Global Market Watch, which proves that everything that you may have been taught in school or they are still teaching in school is just outright wrong. Goes through all the markets historically and records patterns. And if it sees the same pattern in any market, it says, hey, this is going to take off, this is going to crash, this is going to... And it shows that it's the patterns that are uniform, not the fundamentals of a particular market.
Exactly. Trying to outsmart the markets typically backfires. It only makes sense because, you have millions of people placing wagers. So,
well, I think our problem is we try to reduce it down to one thing. The market went up today because, All right. There's never a because. All right. Everybody acts out of their own self-interest. There are Europeans that are buying the market over here, not because of what we see domestically. It's because Europe is so bad, let me just get out of here. So everybody acts for different reasons. And this is why the computer is able to beat it, everybody, because it's looking for patterns. Everybody's going to respond according to their own self-interest. So it's the pattern of everybody, the movement. It's not what the fundamental is.
You're right. And I think it's that the human mind was originally hardwired over many thousands of years and probably much longer to look for cyclical patterns. I mean, look, we see the sunrise in the morning. It sets every night. This has happened for eternity, and it's going to continue to happen for another 5 billion years or so.
That's how we learn. I mean, every parent tells a child, don't stick your finger in the flame of a candle. It's going to hurt. Every child looks at the parent and says, really? And sticks his finger in, right?
Exactly. And you've got the seasons, okay? Right? We have the four seasons in most parts of in the Northern Hemisphere. And so these are the patterns that we've been hardwired. But the problem is, when you look at the markets, okay, it's a complex system. It's not a regular cyclical system. And that's where, genetic algorithms and expert systems can take that quantum leap to the next level, that the everyday human is just not wired properly. Princeton Economics, Martin Armstrong. We want to wish you a really fantastic 2016. We've got another year headed here. Let's hope it's a better one. I want everyone to see the Forecaster movie.
Have a good holiday.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.